everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Laura Kalba, the author of Color in the Age of Impressionism, Commerce, Technology, and Art. And the book was published by Penn State University Press in 2017. Hi there, Laura.
Hi, Roxane. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
I think my choice to study French culture, French history was overdetermined, meaning also perhaps that I didn't really have a lot of imagination. I think the first most determining factor is the fact that I grew up in Montreal and I attended French elementary school, French high school, junior college, what we call CEGEP. And from a very early age, for me, school was French and mm-hmm. French was school. I spoke English at home with my family. And at university, the books that kind of most inspired me were either written by French authors or about France in one way or another. And here, you know, I'm thinking about important books for me at a young age were Roland Barthes' Mythologies, Pierre Bourdieu's Distinction. And it was also a time where cultural history, history of memory was really important. So Pascal Ory, Matt Matsuda. I remember reading Charles Rurik and Dan Sherman. And then finally also Vanessa Schwartz, who eventually became my PhD advisor at USC.
So Laura, in the introduction to the book, you described the project as one that, and I'm quoting you here, analyzes the impact of new color technologies on French visual and material culture from the early commercialization of synthetic dyes around 1857 to the Lumière brothers' perfection of the autochrome color photography process around 1907. So there's so much I want to ask you in this time that we have, but let's just start with these two, you know, the big words in the first part of the title of the book, color and impressionism. And I'm going to kind of flip them by starting with the impressionists and impressionism. You make the point that the impressionists were controversial in part because of their unconventional use of color. So can we start by having you give us a sense of what impressionist color was, what it means, and why it stirred up such a fuss?
Sure. I think in a way, this might be the aspect of the book that the readers might be most familiar with, to the extent that there's been a longstanding fascination with impressionist so-called bigger, brighter palette. The fact that their color choices were not only unusual for the time, namely by virtue of the fact of kind of limiting tonal variation, the variation that is to say between kind of darker and lighter, but also just simply by introducing colors that were unfamiliar, having, you know, coloring their blacks, adding a little bit of blue or purple in a shadow, highlighting the brighter, kind of flashier aspects of visual culture. And this has been a kind of central part of discussions of Impressionism from the moment, you know, they first emerged on the scene in the kind of 1870s and through the kind of the critical and art historical literature reflection. So I guess it depends on how you define impressionist palette. On the one hand, you can think about it quite literally in terms of which pigments did they use. And there again, there's quite a substantial literature stemming from art conservation, investigating the new synthetic pigments that they adopted, or there's the kind of broader reflection about color and the impressionists, which is many times either a kind of condemnation of their unusual, disorienting color choices, or a celebration of impressionists' exploration of color as being a kind of final liberation from the strictures of realistic representation.
Well, and it seems to be meaningful, Laura, that the title, the pre-colon part of the title is Color in the Age of Impressionism, not Color and the Impressionists.
It took a while before I came up with that title. I understood that Impressionism was very important for the way that we have come to think about color in art history, and also just about color more specifically in the 19th century. But at the same time, the key question or the key questions I'm trying to answer are not simply about a group of artists or, you know, the specific artworks that they created between, let's say, the 1870s and the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So I take Impressionism as a way of thinking through developments in color that happened more broadly in the late 19th century. And I think it is it in a way that illuminates both new things about popular commercial visual culture and the Impressionists.
So let's take on this term and idea that runs throughout the book, obviously, color. You make a few different distinctions between the work that you're doing in this book and some of the other work that is out there, both within art history and the history of color, that this is not a book that's just about an opposition between chromophobes or people who disliked color or new uses or innovations with color versus people who may have, you know, appreciated the new and changes with respect to the world of color, that you're interested in aesthetic debates, but that you're also interested in what you describe as the pronounced social and political implications of debates. The idea that the history of color is also a history of class, and gender, and technology, and business. So could you just talk a little bit about the ways that this study of color is different, the kind of intervention that you're wanting to make in this study in the broader field of scholarship on color?
So in the history of color, there has been traditionally a focus, you know, as you mentioned, on taste, advice manuals, prescriptive literature that advised generally women on their outfits, on how to decorate their homes. Mm. And what informed this prescriptive literature, specifically with regards to color, is a certain amount of anxiety about social heterogeneity, or that there was a proliferation of different colors, that women were picking gaudy, mismatched outfits. And what informed the prescriptive literature was a notion that by ordering the world of color, one ordered and gave form to taste and therefore order to society more generally. Since the early 19th century, there was an association between color and a certain kind of primitive nature. Color was associated with children, with women, and other kind of so-called primitive peoples, including, you know, the working class and overseas populations. And this was a kind of at the core of Europeans' debates surrounding color and their anxieties about what this new, more colorful consumer culture really meant.
You describe this book, Laura, as a history of modern visual perception in this period from the bottom up. And you've already sort of hinted at this in some ways, that this isn't just a book about the use of color in high art, for example, but it's really a book about how color and colors were made in this period in new and different ways. So could you say a little bit more about this idea of doing color from the bottom up?
Absolutely. And I think in a way this gets to the core question and helps elucidate a little bit also the role that kind of Impressionism plays within the book. Mm-hmm. More than the story that I kind of just told about, you know, the kind of battle between the chromophiles and the chromophobes, between you could say the ordinary consumer and the tastemakers, what really interested me was the fact that the development of a new consumer culture, increasingly based on the sensual appeal of color, ended up challenging dominant modes of visual understanding, visual perception, and in particular, challenged the way people understood realism, abstraction, and fantasy. Mm-hmm. So when I'm talking about investigating the history of visual perception and color from the bottom up, what I'm interested in exploring and what I do in all the different chapters is look at ways that the democratization of colorful images and objects made people rethink what realism meant, abstraction meant, and fantasy. And this approach is, in a way, you know, goes beyond simply Impressionism, for one, and also really draws inspiration from the literature like, you know, Jonathan Crary's Techniques of the Observer, where he talks about, you know, the modernization of vision and this same type of blurring of categories of visual understanding. But his approach is primarily from the perspective of the history of medicine or psychology, or what at the time was known as kind of psychophysics. And I love Techniques of the Observer. And at the same time, my approach to understanding the history of visuality was from a kind of very different angle. And in particular, I was interested in thinking about how the images and objects that circulated in everyday environments made people, again, shift their way of thinking about what they saw and its meaning. Meaning that as opposed to defining vision and color perception through the field of psychology and medicine, I looked for the implicit ways that ordinary French men and women understood color.
So in the book, Laura, you sort of trace the contours of this color revolution in this period and the emergence of this, you know, what you describe as a new visual landscape. And, you know, reading these chapters about not just the Impressionists, but about flower making and gardening and dyes and fireworks and just an array of materials and objects and everyday encounters with color, I had the question too, the one that you pose in the introduction, why has color been neglected in scholarship on 19th century? So what is it that has made color something that hasn't been explored in quite these ways up to now?
I think there has been a literature on the history of color, but not from within the field of, you could say, cultural history or within the field of visual culture. That is to say, there's a much more traditional early 20th century art historical approach to color. There's also the scholarship, the contributions of John Gage in particular, that tried to relate artists to contemporaneous color theory. And there's also that more technical scholarship that comes out from art conservation. And that these have been the dominant ways of understanding color in the field of art history, let's say. And it took a while, in a way, for these questions to be reformulated and reimagined through the lens of visual culture and popular culture. I think photography was so dominant in the field of visual studies in the early 2000s. And photography, I think, is one of the ways that black and white photography shapes our image of the 19th century so profoundly. Mm-hmm. It requires some imagination to recolorize those images. But once we are presented with autochromes, which is kind of the first commercially successful color photography process, and it's introduced in the early 20th century, it seems so obvious that the 19th century was full of colorful shop signs, kiosks, posters, and of course, you know, women with their, you know, flashy garments. As to why scholars of visual culture have been slow to think about that, I think, you know, photography is one reason, and also in thinking about form. In popular commercial culture, there has been a focus on, I would say, collage and shock, the category of the concept, rather, of vernacular modernism that is introduced by Miriam Hansen, and it relates specifically to film. Has that model really kind of prompted scholars to think about the intersection between modernism and modernity from the perspective of collage and shock rather than color? Mm-hmm. And then I think lastly, some of the kind of key thinkers that were informing the field of visual studies in the early 2000s, and Georg Simmel in particular, you know, he writes about money and modernity as basically the modern metropolis being gray and colorless as a result of the equalizing effect of money that turns everything into a quantitative value. But this, of course, has more to do with his own analysis of modernity and money than visual experience in the late 19th century. I have to say also, perhaps if there's one last reason why color has been perhaps neglected, I think it's authors' fears that they wouldn't get a publisher to accept publishing a book that required so many colorful images. There were plenty of half-mythical stories out there that made me wonder whether I'd made the right choice or whether this project was simply doomed because I'd need color images. And that's one of the reasons, actually, that I include the anecdote about Chevreul, Michel-Eugène Chevreul, at the very beginning of the book, because he finished writing his magnum opus, De la loi du contrat simultané des couleurs, in 1835, and then it took him 3 years to find someone who would be willing to publish it. So maybe that's the last, you know, kind of more pregnant market, money-oriented reason why people have been slow to investigate color.
Well, I mean, I just want to stop there for a second, because I think this was the first question I wanted to ask you, or the first thing I wanted to comment on, which is what a beautiful book this is. I wanted to both congratulate you on the design of this book, which, I mean, this is a sound podcast, so I can't hold it up to show people, but they will see some images of it if they go online at the publisher site or elsewhere, to congratulate you, but also to ask if you had any comments on the design of the book and how it came together.
I am delighted with the work of the designer. And so I need to mention her by name, Jo Ellen Ackerman. She did a fantastic job. And in terms of the press, I think I also need to highlight how there was funding available. And I am the recipient of two different subventions, one from the Art History Publication Initiative and also a Miller Meese Award from the College Art Association. So that helped pay for image rights and also for the production of the book. And then Jo Ellen really kind of did a fantastic job putting it all together. It was that moment where you go from, you know, simply having a manuscript to something that looks like an actual book. I'm still smiling, actually, because I remember it so vividly.
Yeah. Laura, I have to ask you, what is French about this story and how you understand this history as a French history? Is there something distinctively French about color in the age of Impressionism?
My answer might be disappointing, I think, to some of your listeners, in that I don't think that fundamentally what I'm talking about, namely the development of a consumer culture that has color as one of its kind of key features, is fundamentally French, nor do I think that what I'm describing in terms of the blurring of the boundaries between realism, abstraction, and fantasy is quintessentially French in some way. But there are both historical and historiographical reasons why it makes sense to tell this story from a French perspective. In terms of the historical reasons, in the 19th century, France played a really important role in the development of a number of different color technologies. French chemists were not the first to develop the coal tar dyes, but they played a fundamental role in developing, you know, the second and third and subsequent dyes. And furthermore, France continued to be the unchallenged leader in terms of fashion in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So even when the dye factories were located predominantly in Germany in the 1880s, 1890s, they continued to pay attention to what women wanted and designers wanted in Paris. Likewise, in terms of gardening, in terms of the development of color fireworks, which I also discuss, and finally, in terms of chromolithography and also color photography, French innovators really play an important role. Mm-hmm. But I'd say that the historiographical reasons are perhaps just as important, to the extent that Impressionism, the history of modern art. Obviously, France plays a kind of key role in that story. And therefore, it made sense, I think, to use France as a kind of starting point for perhaps a kind of broader reflection about modern visual culture.
The book, Laura, is organized thematically, with each chapter focusing on a particular color technology, and I want us to talk about each of those now. The first chapter of the book focuses on the color theories of a famous French chemist. So what can you tell us about him, and why was he so important in this period, and in particular important to the history that you're trying to get at?
Michel Eugène Chevreul is the French chemist in question. Mm-hmm. So he is, to a certain extent, a well-known figure, both in the history of science and in art history. He was a kind of well-established organic chemist. And this is the period of history where organic chemistry is still just emerging. In 1824, he is named the director of the dye works of the Manufacture des Gobelins, the kind of state-run tapestry workshop. And it's in the context of the work he's doing there as director of the dye works that he develops and codifies, we could say, the law of the simultaneous contrast of color. It's basically the notion that the appearance of a color is always affected by the color or colors that are placed next to it. That hue and tone of one color affects the appearance of the other. So in addition to that, he also develops a system for color naming. This system was mostly kind of popularized in the form of color wheels, but he initially presented it in the form of a three-dimensional hemisphere representing approximately 14,400 different colors.
Wow.
And thanks to this system, he proposed basically substituting what he described as vague, fantastical color names with precise numerical coordinates.
So it's Pantone, basically.
Exactly. And this was, you know, in a way inspired by the classification system in natural history, and also on the kind of privileging of quantitative measurement in chemistry. But it actually was extremely difficult to create these color wheels. And in fact, you know, to my knowledge, and to as far as I can tell, other scholars have also come to the same conclusions, the 14,400 colors that were in his system were never actually executed in the form of color wheels or hemispheres or what have you.
So in the second chapter of the book, Laura, you focus on flowers, the growing and selling of flowers and the commodity culture of the 19th century, the idea of new flower varietals, artificial flowers and colors in gardening and the visual experience of gardens. So yeah, what can you tell us about how flowers contributed to this? The history of flowers is also a part of this history of color that's evolving in this period of the 19th century.
I think the chapter on what I call floriculture, the mm-hmm. culture of flowers, is an important one in a way because it challenges the dichotomy between the natural and the artificial. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy to think that it's simply about the introduction of synthetic artificial colors and that these come from industry. And that in opposition to this, there is this sacrosanct natural world that is untouched by human hands. So in this chapter, what I look at is how starting definitely with more regularity in the 1830s and 1840s, there are French horticulturalists and nurserymen who are importing exotic flowers from faraway lands, South America, Africa, and then progressively throughout the century, there is a perfecting of hybridization and crossing in order to create new varieties of flowers. And oftentimes, there are multiple different goals, you know, to make the flowers bigger, the plants healthier, for them to be easily marketable. And as part of this marketing and the quest for novelty, that is to say, the selling of flowers to an increasingly, you know, growing number of hobbyists, there is the pursuit of different colors. So where there weren't any white flowers of this particular type before, they'll try to introduce them. And in particular, geraniums are very fashionable. And there's a proliferation of different varieties and colors. And it is clear from reading this literature and on the hybridization of flowers and also on the popularization of gardening as a hobby among the middle classes that the world of flowers was just as much influenced by fashion trends as that of, you know, women's garments. So it allows us to rethink precisely this boundary between the natural and the artificial, and think about, in a way, flowers as a color technology, and also definitely makes us rethink the history of artificial flowers, which I was and continue to be particularly interested in. And the key question there among flower makers, by which I mean artificial flower makers, is whether workers should simply use color to create flowers that resemble those found in nature, however artificial nature had become, or alternatively, they should let their imagination run free and create what was called a fleur de fantaisie, that is to say, flowers which primarily through their color don't resemble anything found in nature. So you get the blue roses or the bronze petunias. And this is one way here where color kind of serves as the focus of a broader reflection about realism or fantasy.
So the third chapter of the book, Laura, focuses on impressionist painting. And you're looking at things like the growing popularity of synthetic dyes, new ideas about color, the role of fashion. So can you tell us which artists you're looking at in this chapter and why they're significant to your story?
The three artists I talk about are Edgar Degas, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, and Claude Monet. And I pick them because they had, I think, the most interesting and complementary takes on the color revolution of the 19th century. And when I, you know, when I say takes, I think that is reveals the fact that I'm not only interested in how the impressionists represented the world around them, the more colorful world beyond the studio. I think what is their most significant contribution to the color revolution, in a way, is their own critical reflection and interpretation of what I describe as a kind of chemical aesthetic. So I'm interested in how they critically comment upon this experience of color as being bright, varied, and often also very fugitive, that is to say, evanescent. In the case of Edgar Degas, he's the one who is the most technically minded and most frequently compared to a scientist. He experiments with a lot of different techniques, different media. He also investigates color in his artworks in ways that draw focused attention to these issues of, you know, variety and also evanescence. When you look at his, you know, very well-known series of paintings of ballerinas and also, you know, pastels, the titles also bring attention to color variety. That is to say, the titles are often things like ballerinas in blue, ballerinas in pink, ballerinas in pink and green. In fact, in one instance, he kind of ironically refers to his paintings as mes articles, you know, referring to articles of trade, referring to, and sometimes kind of ironically, to consumer culture and the role that color plays in consumer culture. Whereas Renoir is just as invested and cognizant of this color revolution. In fact, you know, he pays just as much attention to women's attire, the bright colors that they're wearing. But when Renoir himself is asked to comment on color and in particular chemistry, he has absolutely nothing good to say. And in fact, he is kind of nostalgic towards the early modern era when artists used to make their paints themselves. And the last instance is I talk about Monet, and Monet's case in a way was the most challenging because Monet's, unlike Renoir, just simply doesn't say anything about chemistry. When Monet is talking about his work and talking about color, it's exclusively about trying to capture, you know, light and particular weather effects. His letters are exclusively dealing with that. And I kind of come up with an explanation for why, in a way, Monet was unable to reconcile the material color of fashion and even of artists' paints with the pursuit of color as light. And that has been the kind of traditional interpretation of Monet as the kind of most representative, perhaps, of the Impressionists has always been about his interest in the ephemeral effects of light and, you know, various weather conditions, and never about his engagement with the color of fashion and ordinary visual material culture. And I think there are interesting reasons for his inability to reconcile these two worlds. And that's what I explore in that chapter.
So the fourth chapter of the book, Laura, I mean, I looked forward to reading all of these chapters, but the fourth one, I think, made me the most jealous of you, that you got to write a whole chapter about fireworks. It's so fascinating, these large-scale pyrotechnic spectacles that you explore in this chapter. And it also makes me want to ask you, I mean, this is true in all of the chapters that in the book, but in this one, that you're looking at these different types of sources to get at the visual culture of this period. In this case, the business records of a fireworks company that is still operational. Is that right?
That is correct. And so these are the records of the Ruggieri company, mm-hmm. and which then became the Lacroix Ruggieri company. And it now is known as the Etienne Lacroix Group. And I do have to explicitly thank now the owners of the company, in particular Etienne and Jean-Jacques Barès, and also especially Evelyne Castera, who granted me access to mm-hmm. these business archives. And this is what identifies me in certain ways as a historian, first and foremost, is that I love archival research so much. And in particular, the more difficult, the better. Mm. And business history, of all the kind of different types of archival research that I've done, has often been kind of the most exciting, the most rewarding. And in this case, it meant, you know, heading out to a suburb of Toulouse, staying overnight with Evelyne Castera, and just going through documents they had in the basement, and also not being able to visit the entire fireworks plant because, you know, most of these areas were restricted because they were full of explosives. And that was so really one of kind of my fondest memories. And also, I think, shows how one of the distinct features of my kind of research methods and what makes it, I think, most significantly different from what a lot of my colleagues in art history are doing, is that very often the sources that I use to answer these questions, which are art historical in one way or another, which are about the period I of the 19th century, these sources are sources that are more familiar to historians of technology and to business historians. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, basically stems from my training in history and from the conviction that in order to study popular commercial culture, you have to go where the commerce is. Mm-hmm. And looking at business records, looking at what is still around from the documents, the activities, the kind of both the commercial motivations that spurred, in this case, the Ruggieri's development of colorful fireworks. This is really a key part of the story that can't be substituted with either kind of more intellectual history type sources or theorizations.
And you also talk about the kind of connections here between the visual culture and thinking and rhetoric of capitalism in this period and the spectacles that were often put on by political authorities in France, you know, and fireworks kind of being at the center of many of them. So that I found that really fascinating as well.
Yeah, and this is typically a story that's told about the rise of authoritarian governments in the 20th century, the adoption of commercial, spectacular culture by, again, authoritarian 20th century governments. Mm-hmm. But if we take into consideration what's happening in consumer culture broadly, that is to say, an intense focus on color, variety, bright colors more specifically, mm-hmm. and understand that pyrotechnists, those developing fireworks, are also very much participating in this development of a kind of brighter, more varied palette. It allows us to reconsider what Napoleon III is doing. That is to say, we see the coincidence between his political agenda, which was very much based on the organization of these massive public celebrations, and consumer culture that is, you know, not only present in the form of colorful fireworks, but also in department stores and in gardens and mm-hmm. in dye factories.
Chapter 5, Laura, is focused on chromolithographic reproduction. So please mm-hmm. tell us what chromolithographic reproduction is and what forms it takes in this period.
So chromolithography is the first technology that allows for the democratization, mass production of full color images. Mm-hmm. And so when talking about chromolithography, we're talking about a specific lithographic printing technique that is multicolored. Now, lithography in its ordinary black and white form had been around since the very late 18th century. And in the beginning of the 20th century, the beginning of the 19th century, there were various attempts at producing multicolored lithographs. It's not, however, until Angelmann's development of basically a frame, a chase, in the late 1830s, that chromolithography becomes just simply easier to produce. And so what happens is that, let's say, from the 1830s to the 1860s, there are increasingly more colorful, full-color images. A lot of these chromolithographic prints are reproductions of works of fine art. And these are what were called basically artistic lithographs. There's a really interesting story, in a way, about bourgeois taste and the desire to have access to fine art in a reproduced form. But additionally, what happens is that starting even during this period, say between the 1830s and 60s, there are other applications of chromolithography. We see, for instance, labels being printed by Angelmann. We see maps, etc. There is, however, a decisive turning point in the 1860s with the development of mechanical presses, which are first steam powered and then powered with electricity. And with that shift, it really becomes possible to produce full color disposable images. And this, again, I think what people perhaps most associate with chromolithography in the late 19th century are the large posters by Jules Chéret. And, you know, they're so familiar that you can buy them in reproduced form in every souvenir shop in Paris. And this is typically what people think of when they think of chromolithography in the late 19th century. Now, one of the reasons that this has become the most well-studied, well-known form of color printing in part has to do with the fact that art critics and fairly well-to-do collectors, almost exclusively men, collected these posters and wrote about how the posters of Jules Chéret and Toulouse-Lautrec were essentially works of art worthy of being regarded as such. Simultaneously, however, and often emerging from the very same print shops that produce posters, there's a host of other colorful imagery that's being produced, and I focus in particular on trade cards, in part because on the surface, at least, they're the exact opposite of what posters are. These trade cards are fairly small. They fit in, you know, the palm of your hand. They're kind of have often like ridiculous imagery. I reproduced one in the book where it's seemingly a bunch of children who are being asphyxiated by particularly smelly cheese, or there are images of models with human heads. And these trade cards were a form of advertisement like the posters. Often the imagery did not relate with a particular business or product being advertised. But what's interesting is that these were also collector's items. And so I kind of try to figure out how well-to-do men connected with the avant-garde associate themselves with the poster and elevate it out of the realm of ephemera, in which basically these trade cards are relegated. So in order to make this distinction, in order to elevate the poster to the realm of fine art, there has to be basically a kind of social and cultural capital associated with it. And by putting these two forms of chromolithography side by side, I'm able to point more clearly to how that happens, how the process of the poster being art as opposed to ephemera involves the investment of a large amount of social, economic, and cultural capital.
It's really interesting. I mean, of course, gender plays a role in different ways throughout the book, but it really comes through, I mean, I think most forcefully in some ways in this chapter where you're looking at this kind of form that is associated maybe with women and children collectors, but then these bourgeois men who kind of get in on the visual cultural scene through their use or their, you know, exchange or discussions of these images and these posters. The epilogue of the book, Laura, talks about the end of the age of Impressionism and about autochromes and neo-Impressionism. So first, if you could just kind of give us a little sketch of neo-Impressionism, but yeah, what was color photography's impact? How did it work as a turning point in this epilogue that closes the book?
Mm-hmm. I consider together neo-Impressionism and autochromes in part because they have certain formal similarities, that is to say, and had been compared previously both by contemporaneous sources and since then in the kind of art historical literature. And this formal similarity is you know, quite simple, is the fact that the neo-impressionists, and here I'm thinking about artists such as Georges Seurat and mm-hmm. Paul Signac, are known for their pointillism. They are the people, you know, the artists who embrace the dot and whose interpretation of color involves applying small touches of color onto mm-hmm. the canvas. And likewise, in a way, the autochrome, this early 20th century color photography process, relied on small little particles of potato starch, mm-hmm. And created the impression of color through dots. And autochromes, I think it's important to remind people, are singular positive images, and are glass plates, so that they're slides. Mm-hmm. And since the invention of photography in 1839, there's constantly discussion and anticipation of color photography. And what happens in a way is that when this new process is finally commercially available, it does some, in a way, some catching up. And by this, I mean that photographers direct their camera toward all the different subjects and visual experiences associated with the color revolution of the previous century. So they are photographing gardens and flower cellars in the streets. They are photographing kind of spectacular, fantastical scenes like acrobats. They are chronicling, in a way, the impact of the color revolution on Paris. So what they end up constituting is not simply a document of Paris as it exists in the early 20th century, but it's in fact a kind of visual archive of the color revolution. And there's something also quite distinctive about autochromes as a technology, is that these color plates are actually, you know, quite large. They require long exposure, and the first users of autochrome plates often comment on how it's a technology that is reminiscent of the first days of photography. So there's almost a kind of thinking of color photography as both cutting edge, but also retro. It is a technology which reminds users of the beginnings of photography, and then through their subject matter, they are in a way turning their camera towards different examples of how the world became more colorful, but in the previous century, leading to basically a kind of retro or nostalgic take on a nostalgic interpretation of color in photographic form. What is striking in a way is what I describe as the retro quality of autochromes is also present in neo-impressionism, to the extent that they seek to reflect upon the history of impressionism, right, mm-hmm. as their name indicates, and that their subject matter and their technique involves a certain form of synthesis and consolidation. So the way I see these two developments as interconnected is precisely in their attempt to summarize the both the art historical and popular commercial aspects of the color revolution of the 19th century.
Reading the book, Laura, I feel like, from my limited, you know, knowledge of the fin du siècle, I feel like the book really confirms the fin du siècle as this turning point. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I feel like, you know,
I either
should confess, like, you got me.
Oh, no. I wasn't trying.
No. I think it's fair kind of to go back full circle in a way. The authors I was reading as an undergraduate at Concordia University in Montreal also posited that the fin du siècle was this pivotal moment associated with the birth of modernity. And I find it very difficult to challenge that narrative in a way. I'm a convert, and I don't really try to provide a significantly different take on modernity and capitalism and the democratization of politics and all the other things that are associated with this key moment in history. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think that all of the 20th and 21st century was present in embryonic form in the fin de siècle. Obviously not. And yet, I am interested in many ways in looking at this period as bringing forth some of the questions about culture, about visual culture, and the construction of meaning in an increasingly capitalist world. These questions that, you know, continue to be important to me just as I live my life, you know. And so it's one of the reasons that, including for my second project in a way, I'm still in the late 19th century.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about next and last. What are you working on now?
I am working on my second kind of major project is on the visual and material representation of economic value. I think what I'm interested in thinking about is how images and objects and places come to embody new notions of economic value that emerge in the late 19th century with the growth of the financial industry, which is, in a way, fundamentally disturbing certain traditional notions of what is economically valuable. More concretely, I'm interested in the architecture of stock exchanges. This is more of a transnational project that involves both France, Great Britain, and different parts of the world where their financial interests intersected. So I have, you know, chapters on the architectures of stock exchanges and a bank in Istanbul. And I also have other chapters on money and money-like objects. So ranging from a chapter on coin designed by Oscar Rotzi, the kind of iconic La Semeuse, which in fact still appears on the French euro coin, and also the collection study and display of so-called, you know, primitive currencies from all around the empire, and how these different images and objects both give form to and challenge notions of economic value in the late 19th and early 20th century.
That sounds great. And I hope you'll keep me posted on the progress of that project. Laura, I just want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing and producing this beautiful book.
It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.